Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and I have a great novel to recommend to you today. It's called Saturday Night at the Lakeside Supper Club, and we have the author with us. J. Ryan Straddle was born and raised in Minnesota, where supper clubs were easily found, as they were and are in Wisconsin. His other books, the two bestsellers, Kitchens of the Great Midwest and The Lager Queen of Minnesota, they're also, of course, set in the Upper Midwest. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've already read Saturday Night at the Lakeside Supper Club. What'd you think about it? Do you know a place like the Lakeside Supper Club? We'd love to have you part of the conversation. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. J. Ryan Straddle, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, Larry. It's an honor to be here.
Well, you grew up in the southern Minnesota town of Hastings, and all your novels are kind of set in that area, but you live in California. I'm wondering, is writing about the Midwest your way of being a part of it without having to deal with the snow and cold?
Well, that's a beautiful way of putting it. I do opt into the snow and cold sometimes when I come back to visit friends and relatives. But yeah, I came out here for work 25 years ago and just kind of stuck around. But it's clear where my heart is. And when I talk about home, I mean the Upper Midwest. I still don't quite feel at home here, but most of my best friends out here are native Midwesterners. I've got two of my best friends are from Oconomowoc and Shorewood. So, we find each other out here, and we'll get together and fry up some brats.
Well, you know, maybe just to start, maybe give us a brief description of the book. We already have some callers online, but give us a brief description.
Oh, awesome.
And then we'll talk more specifics later.
It's 100 years in the life of a supper club, and it follows four generations, therefore. So it begins in the 1930s and comes all the way up to the present day, mostly from the perspective of the women who work at the supper club. And yeah, it tells the story of a family, its loves, its losses, its future, its legacy, all within the walls of this beautiful, iconic restaurant.
Yeah, you certainly nailed the atmosphere, I think, of a supper club. Do you have a special one in your past?
Oh, yeah. In my past, it's not around anymore, but the Steamboat Inn in Prescott, Wisconsin, I worked there as a teenager. It was right across the river from where I grew up in Hastings, and wonderful place. Best restaurant in the area. At the time, we spent all our significant birthdays and celebrations there. It's where we took important guests from out of town, like great-grandma.
Yeah,
where we celebrated my high school graduation. It was such an honor to actually work there. It was like, for me, working at working at Disneyland or or the Smithsonian or a place like that might be to some people. It was a really significant place in my young life.
So,
now among ones that still exist, I love Wiederholtz in Meesville.
You were really able. I guess your work, you were because you worked there. You were really able to catch the kind of the atmosphere and what goes on in a supper club. You do that. You did that so well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I also got to interview my old boss, Mike Rowan. he's retired now, living in Florida. The Steamboat Inn is gone. He moved on to other restaurants, but he told me stories that made the book. I won't tell you which ones, but some of the incidents in the at the Lakeside Supper Club are Steamboat Inn incidents. And also some are, I interviewed the owners of the Dorf House in Roxbury. Rebecca and Monty Meyer, and they gave me some details that made the book as well. And their supper club is mentioned near the end of the book.
Yeah. Yeah. Mary and Rubicon, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi there.
Good morning, Larry. Hi, Jay. Thanks for the book. Hey.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much.
We were just up at Lake Delton in Wisconsin at Ishnala Supper Club.
Oh, yeah. Classic.
And it is That's the first time we had been there. It was marvelous. It was so, they were, everybody working there was happy. They were attentive. It was just a real joy to have that special supper club here. And I just wanted to thank you for the book.
Oh, well, Mary, thank you very much. For just a comment, Jay, Ryan?
Oh, well, that's a classic supper club. That's one of the iconic ones anywhere.
Yeah.
And thank you for reading and feeling like I captured some of that atmosphere in my own fictional supper club, which isn't, I got to say, isn't based on one specific one. I also named it the Lakeside because there's been quite a few supper clubs over the years named the Lakeside. So I thought, okay, I'm not picking on just one here. including there was one in Oconomowoc. So yeah, that I'd been to years ago. So I thought, and one in Matamita, Minnesota as well. So yeah, I wasn't basing it on one, but supper clubs like Ishinala were certainly a model for my fictional supper club.
Yeah. It's interesting, supper club. You know, back in the day, we had, you know, when I was growing up, we had breakfast, dinner, and supper.
Mm, yeah, that's right.
And
that's
supper,
what my dad said.
Supper mm-hmm. was the evening meal, and I imagine that's where the supper club part of it started.
Mm-hmm.
Because people assumed supper was dinner. What we now call dinner.
Right, right. That's awesome. Yeah, I haven't heard talk of that since my dad. He grew up on a farm, and he said that they had breakfast, lunch, dinner, supper.
Oh.
So they still had lunch, but I think lunch was like smaller, like a break between breakfast and dinner. Yeah, but yeah, no, the dinner and supper thing is something I grew up hearing about.
Yeah. Well, Mary, thank you so much for calling. By the way, you can join in too. A comment or a question, maybe a comment about supper clubs or a comment about the book, question about them. I hope you join in. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. There's really two places that you, well, there's more than two. There's the Lakeside, of course, is what we're talking about and what that may represent to you. But there's also the Majestic Lodge.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's a throwback. That's a throwback to kind of the golden age of supper clubs. Well, I'd say now we're still in a golden age. I don't want to say that. But yeah. There was an age of supper clubs where they were full-on entertainment venues. And even before they were called supper clubs, places that became supper clubs were joints where occasionally celebrities of all stripes and reputations would come in. There was one in Reamer, Minnesota that was famous for hosting Al Capone whenever he needed to lay low for a bit. And I'm sure Wisconsin supper clubs have similar stories of, you know, the occasional person who would come up and have a meal who maybe didn't want to be seen. But yeah, the Majestic was my tip of hat to that era of Minnesota Lake Country and its role in American culture in the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Yeah. Yeah, there are plenty in northern Wisconsin of places that where Capone or Babyface Nelson and quite a few of those fellas. And they were always really welcomed, just as an aside, because they were big spenders and they and they always tipped really well and people knew enough to not call the cops about them.
Mm-hmm.
Luann in East Troy, we'll just go to you now. Hi, Luann.
Hi, guys. I love the topic, and I'm looking forward to reading that book. I grew up outside of Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and my family went to a supper club called Chuck's Supper Club. It was maybe not on, but right near Silver Lake outside of Oconomowoc. And when I asked my mom what made a supper club versus just any other restaurant, She told me that a supper club serves a relish tray with pickles and olives and maybe carrot sticks, and a supper club served a bread basket with little breadstick packets in it. So I don't know how accurate that is, but that's how I've always defined it in my brain, and I'm wondering how you define a supper club.
Oh, first of all, thanks so much for calling. I love East Troy. There's a wonderful bookstore there called Inklink Books. They do great events. And I know the supper club you're talking about. I think it was renamed Lucky Chuckies. I think it might still be around under a different name. But I agree with your mom. One of the things that, to me, mark a true supper club is the food you get before you even order, which include a relish tray and basket of bread, both things. And in my experience, a relish tray can contain all kinds of items. It's the discretion of the owner. I think the only rule I've seen is that they're almost always cold. You won't get a hot item in a relish tray, but you will get like pickled herring, pickled watermelon rind. One supper club owner's daughter said pickled chicken gizzards was part of her father's relish tray. So it depended where you went. No two could be the same.
Halverson's always served a cream-style herring in their relish tray that I just loved. I could you could just about make a dinner out of, well, you could, I think, dinner out of the relish tray. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Luann, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We're visiting today with J. Ryan Straddle about his book, and we haven't even really gotten into the book too much, but we will. It's titled Saturday Night at the Lakeside Supper Club, and a novel and really, really good read. So I hope you'll join in. If you've read it, give a comment. If not, maybe a question or comment about supper clubs or about our people who are the characters in the book as we move along and talk about them. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear that as well. Jill Nadeau is our producer, by the way. A. Emily Ralph, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the novel Saturday Night at the Lakeside Supper Club, a wonderful read. J. Ryan Straddle, our guest today. He's the author of this book. And as we go along, again, join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's talk about some of the main, and the women are the bedrock kind of the book, I think, at least they were for me. The main characters, certainly the guys were in it as well, but I was most intrigued by the women. Betty's the matriarch, and you know, it was interesting the legacy there of her grandmother Julia Winthrop and how that affected Betty, and that comes really early in the book. But talk about that a little bit.
Wow. You're the first person to ever ask about that. I love it. Yeah, this book is a book about legacy, and I have to admit, I didn't intend to write that. I sat down to write a fun escapist story about supper clubs and taking place over a summer with this mother-daughter relationship, but something happened while I was writing this book. I became a father for the first time, and I started thinking about legacy from a personal perspective. My son Auden was born in December 2019 when I was about halfway through writing the first draft of this book, and I thought, oh boy, this whole journey is gonna find its way into this book. All my hopes and fears for him, but also thinking about how each generation prepares the subsequent one for the world that they've created. And I thought, you know, for Betty to start where she did, her ancestors didn't do a very good job of that.
Yeah.
Like, she's got to kind of start from zero. So when she thinks back on her legacy, she thinks about what wasn't preserved for her. So that's why preservation becomes so important to her. When she takes ownership of the supper club, keeping it going becomes her paramount concern. And it's easy to understand why. I mean, this is a person who'd lost everything that would have passed down to them. So she wanted something to pass down to her descendants, consequently, and that the preservation of those ideals became her main focus in life. And however, as we know, as parents, our children don't always share our values or appreciate the same things we do or for the same reasons. So whether or not the subsequent generations agree with Betty becomes an issue. I mean, Betty's own daughter, Florence, is a very strong-willed person in her own right and has her own ideas of what she wants to do in life and doesn't like restaurant work very much. So this also came out of conversations with separate club owners where, because they're largely family-owned to this day, and one of the things I love about them, and passed from generation to generation. But not every child of each subsequent generation has that enthusiasm to take over restaurant work. Maybe they want to do something else in life. And so that became part of the novel as well.
Yeah, in great ways. Dan, in Poinsett?
Yeah, Larry Poinsett, thanks for taking my call. So I just caught the end of the conversation there about how supper clubs are passed down from generation to generation in a lot of times. And that was my experience as well. But on a different side, my father worked in the same supper club as a busboy that I did when I became a teenager, worked in the same club. And a lot of these waitresses were career waitresses. They worked there for their entire lives, and they knew everybody. Everybody that came in was like a family. And I'll tell you one little joke one waitress would play on guests when they'd come in. She'd take minnows out of the lake and put them in the water pitcher on the table. And then when people would pour their water, the minnows would come out. And they would laugh, but, you know, it was a lot of fun back then. And people didn't take things so seriously, and it was just a blast. One little caveat, that was actually Chuck's Supper Club on Silver Lake.
Ah.
I love that. Oh, my God, that's amazing. Yeah. Yeah, and I do have such a waitress in my own book. There's a waitress named Lois Strunk who shares a last name with my friend from Oconomowoc, as it turns out. And she is a waitress at my Lakeside Supper Club for about 50 years. And I found interviewing supper club owners that, as your caller said, that wasn't unusual. People would do it for life and become part of that community within those walls.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Dan, thanks a lot for that. Yeah. I really appreciate it. Charlotte and Rhinelander.
Mm. Hi, thanks for taking my call. Speaking of supper clubs, Chuck's Supper Club was close to where I lived. And I was there in the summertime. My mother dropped me off at Silver Lake, and I climbed up on the raft out in front of the supper club, and I met my future husband there.
Oh, that's awesome. I love it.
And we didn't eat often at Chuck's, but we spent a lot of time sitting in the bar drinking and visiting with people. Anyway, yeah. Thanks so much.
Charlotte, thanks. You're going to enjoy reading this book if you haven't read it already, because I think that kind of happens in your book, too, in your novel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there are a lot of regulars at the bar, people who don't necessarily have a dinner there, but are such frequent regulars that the bartender knows what they're going to order and has the drink ready for them by the time the front door is unlocked, which is also a practice I heard from a supper club owner. But yeah, Rhinelander, I'm on my book tour. I'm not going there specifically, but I'm coming to Bayfield and Spooner in June. And I think I'll be coming to Wausau later this year as well.
Oh, good. In the Bayfield area, one supper club up there that when I was up muskie fishing, I would go, and this is a long time back, it was the Rainbow Lodge.
Mm.
I love the Rainbow Lodge, and I'm sure the Rainbow Lodge, anybody from up that way, let me know if the Rainbow Lodge is operating. It's probably, if it is, it'd be operating under a different a name, I would imagine. But, you know, and there I was up there in the summertime. And that there's kind of a, if you think about supper clubs, and certainly it comes to the fore in your book, where you had this knot of, this community of people, And they were there all year long. But then kind of in a way, what really paid the bills, or paid a lot of the bills, was summertime. Mm. And then you have all these folks coming from elsewhere to stay in the area, and they would fill those supper clubs up.
Absolutely. Yeah, one of the things I learned from one of the supper club owners I interviewed was that summer vacation was an oxymoron for them. That if they took a vacation, it was a shoulder season at best, more likely, you know, in the winter. So, yeah, summer was all hands on deck. Yeah.
Yeah. But even those folks became part of the community. Many of them would come back every year.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. There were seasonal regulars as well as local regulars.
So a supper club is in, certainly was the case for the Lakeside Supper Club. It's its own community. It has, it develops its own community of people.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons they're so valuable. They're such unique third spaces outside of work or home where you can get together with friends and neighbors. And one of the things I love about supper clubs is they're not waving the bill under your nose after an hour. You can go there and make yourself comfortable, bookend your meal with a brandy old fashioned on one end and a grasshopper on the other.
Yeah.
And just sit back. And at some supper clubs, there's still live music and events and just spaces for people to either hold their own events or just hang out and make themselves comfortable for a few hours. And there's not a lot of restaurants that have that kind of leeway. And they're community assets. And I hope this book inspires people to check out the supper clubs in their community if they haven't yet and give them some business.
Well, let's go back to your characters in the book. Betty, as we said, was the matriarch. And we get started talking about Florence, Betty's daughter. And Florence, we see her whole life.
Absolutely.
Plays out. I thought you did a great job. Well, I thought you did a great job with her all the way through, but I particularly enjoyed her as a young person and how she related to her mother and what she thought about. To me, this is an insightful young person in so many ways.
Yeah, she had to be because of the circumstances in which she was born and raised. She had to develop a real verve and awareness for her own protection. And she was a very smart kid and used that intelligence to, you know, find her way to acquiring things that she knew her mother wouldn't or couldn't provide. So she was clever, but also a tough nut to crack, you know, not the sort of person that was gonna, cross a room to greet somebody, you know. Yeah. You had to get to know her. You had to win her over. You know, she wasn't a very trusting person, understandably. I don't want to give too much away from the book, but, you know, she was a person who very much became her own person early in her life. And, came up with an idea of how she wanted to spend that life. And quite often that was in opposition to her mom and her mom's goals for her. But hey, that's any family. This just happens to be in a restaurant. And that made it a lot of fun to write.
Oh, yeah. She's kind of flinty, I would call it.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Very, very.
And the relationship between Florence and eventually her daughter, Marielle, is that how you
pronounce it? Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And Marielle appears pretty early in the book.
Yeah.
I should say the book I wasn't paying attention when I started reading, and I didn't pay attention to the times on the. and so I sort of the years at the top of each chapter. I didn't do that for the first couple of chapters, and I thought, wait a minute, I got to go back. Oh, why don't you read the whole thing, and then you'll know, you'll understand a little better. I love the way you did that.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Yeah, I really wanted to tell the story of the lifespan of this restaurant over 100 years, and that meant skipping through time a bit and providing context. One of the things that I wanted to get across was the complexity of the relationship between these generations. And in order to do that, I felt I had to portray them. Because if I just told Florence a story from her daughter's perspective, it would be a pretty unfair point of view on Florence. And so I wanted the reader to get to know Florence, because I think if you read this book, the reader will understand Florence better than her own daughter does. And one of the lessons I wanted to get across in this book, or one of the themes, was how it's never too late to be the parent your child needs. And that's something Florence eventually figures out.
Yeah, very touching, some very touching moments there at one point after they go through... what would you call it? A battle of wills.
Very much. Yeah. A mutual stubbornness. Yeah.
A mutual stubbornness, which I hate to go into much more than that, but that in the end leads to that closeness that comes from that. And the last... just to get the rest of the women in here, the last woman we hear about is Julia.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you want to say with her story?
Oh, wow. Yeah, Julia takes us to the present day. So Julia is kind of a chip off her grandmother, Florence. Yeah. How each generation kind of decides for themselves what they're going to keep from the previous generation. And she's wrestling with her mom's legacy. Julia takes us to the present day. And that's probably all I'll say about that in terms of spoilers. But yeah, she's the one who has to consider for herself, like, what does this supper club mean to me? And what's my role in it? And what do I do with this legacy? How do I become a steward of this land and this place? And also, how do I reconcile what I think my mom wanted for me with what I want to do with my life? Yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot going on there with Julia. And I love her chapters. They were my favorite part of the book to write. So I'm eager to hear what readers think of them.
I can tell you that the event... in the last couple of paragraphs in the book were, which I'm not going to divulge, but they were very emotional. Jill, our producer, said, I had tears in my eyes as I was reading those last few chapters. And she said, I wonder, why did he wait for the very end for that? for that to happen, what happens sort of at the end, you know, it could have happened in a lot of different places and it didn't. And you waited right to the end for that to happen.
Right. Well, I knew it was going to happen sooner or later, and I was going to end the book wherever it happened. Like, it could have happened later in Julia's life too. So, yeah. I knew that was going to be the ending before I started writing the book. So I started far away from that ending. that's one cheat code on how to write a novel, is to come up with an ending and then start really far from that ending and fill in the gap. But that's kind of what happened here. As I knew that's how I wanted to end the book, with Julia around that age when she has that revelation and that experience. So I knew I was going to have to set that up over a course of 3 or 4 generations.
You know, here we haven't, we've spent the whole time so far talking, well, we've talked about supper clubs, obviously. We've talked about the women, but we haven't talked at all about the men. And as you say, men are in a role there. Ned, who's Mariel's husband, and his family owned a chain of restaurants. How does the large business compare with the small family supper club?
In my hometown, they were sometimes at odds. I know when certain chain restaurants came into Hastings, it put a lot of strain on the locally owned restaurants and put some out of business. But at the same time, some of those chains, like Perkins in particular, upon whom my fictional restaurant, Jorby's, is partially based, are community assets in their own way. I know when I was a teenager growing up in Hastings, the tolerant 24-hour nature of Perkins was a lifeline for us. That was our third space. I mean, we couldn't afford to eat at a supper club every night, and certainly couldn't hang out at the bar with locals. So Perkins was our third space where we could go, you know, after school, after hours, late at night, and hang out and drink coffee and order the cheapest thing on the menu and sit there for hours and have the formative experience as teenagers that we needed outside of home or school. So, yeah, I don't mean to set this up as some sort of David or Goliath thing, because there are benefits to these places, and they're community assets in their own way. My mom was a waitress at Perkins many times throughout her life before she returned to college at the University of Wisconsin River Falls and got her bachelor's degree in her 30s. She helped support our family by working at Perkins, and I'll always, feel a warmth in my heart about that.
Well, and what I don't know what the number is now, but what is it? One in every 15 kids in the U.S. worked at McDonald's at one point in their life. I don't remember the exact number on it, but it's a. A lot of kids had their first ever job was at a Perkins, or more likely at a McDonald's for the first one, and then they might have moved on to a Perkins.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're right. They performed a big service in many ways in their community. I don't know if I want to deal with it. Maybe just a quick mention. There is some tragedy in the book, and its reaction affects different family members in different ways. Why was that important for the narrative for that to happen, do you think, without even talking?
Well, I knew there was going to have to be an event that divided the family. Both in terms of the effect of the incident itself, as well as people's perspectives on it and their perception of who's to blame. I've seen it in my own family where different points of view on an event have created silence between family members. And one of the things that I'm constantly endeavoring to do in my writing is finding bridges across silence. I think there are too many reasons nowadays that people invent to cut off family members or not talk to them stubbornly oppose them for long periods of time. And so one of the missions I create in my book is to find ways for families to reconcile. And this particular event is one that was extremely hard for family to work at a work past, especially when they decided who was to blame. So I think, the reader is going to agree with who they agree with, but I didn't want to create a bad guy in the situation per se.
There's
no smoking gun per se. There's just different points of view, and people do what they're going to do. I grew up in Minnesota myself with relatives from Wisconsin and North Dakota. And I know the deep-seated stubbornness on both sides of my family and years of silence between siblings. And it's part of Midwestern life to me. And I wanted to just write about a situation that would be extremely difficult to work through without a lot of compromise on both sides. Just to just to demonstrate to myself, just to tell the story to myself that it's possible, that, hey, we can break through this and we can become a family again.
So you've been around the country promoting this book. I got to believe it's doing well, the book. But I'm wondering, what are the reactions from non-Midwesterners?
Oh, they're baffled that such people exist. Yeah. Oh, in California? Oh, boy. You should hear the kind of questions they get in California. They're stumped that someone could be so stubborn as Florence. Or that supper clubs exist, that restaurants give out a free relish tray. Yeah, there's, yeah, just a tremendous amount of confusion about a lot of the habits and traditions that I explore in this novel on the coast. And, you know, I'm okay with that. The one fun thing about it, though, is that when I'm touring the West Coast, I'll ask, okay, who here knows what a supper club is? And maybe a handful of hands go up here. And they're quite often people from Wisconsin or Minnesota or Michigan. So, yeah. And they'll help the rest of the audience understand what I'm talking about. And thankfully, the rest are interested. And hopefully the next time they're on vacation in Michigan, Wisconsin, or Minnesota, they'll check out a supper club. And they'll be interested in participating in this asset in these communities.
Well, I was thinking about sometimes traveling to other parts of the outside of the Midwest, and you go and you want to go and ask somebody, where's a good fish fry on Friday night? And they look at you like you're nuts.
Yeah, I know.
Well, you have done just a marvelous job. The book is doing well. I mean, your other two were bestsellers.
Yeah, it started off as the number one hardcover fiction bestseller in the Midwest the week it came out. Well, yeah, in independent bookstores across the Midwest, it was the top seller. It was the number seven bestseller among independent bookstores nationwide. So yeah, I got off to a good start. And I'm just pinching myself about that. I just can't believe it. You know that, man. I'm a kid from a working class family in Hastings, Minnesota. This isn't supposed to happen. I feel tremendously lucky and blessed that I get to write these books and tour for them and meet the readers that choose to come out. I'm beside myself that this is happening. So I just want to, I want to thank you for having me on the show and enabling me to talk about this experience and talk about supper clubs and talk about this novel, because I still can't believe it's happening.
Well, I can believe it. It is so well written. You are such a good writer. You handle dialogue. Oh man, you are so good with dialogue, and I was just captivated by the book. I got it I don't remember when I got it, a month or so ago, and I thought, I'll just take a quick look at it. Well, then I got right into it, and I had a very hard time putting it down. And I was sad when it ended. And I'm looking forward to your next one, whatever it may be, Jay Ryan. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Larry. It's been an honor.
Jay Ryan Straddle, I highly recommend Saturday Night at the Lakeside Supper Club. I'm pretty sure you're going to love this book if you haven't read it already. If you have, I'm pretty sure you loved it. And when he gets another book out, we're going to have him back. I can tell you that for free. Thank you again, Jay Ryan. Oh, well, we talked about, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about the women, the girls and the women from Jay Ryan's book. But we're going to turn our attention now to boys and raising boys. There's a wonderful new book out. It's called Building Boys. And our guest, Jennifer Fink, the author, will be with us next. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.